The subject of using stem cells in therapy and stem cell research has become very controversial in recent years, particularly since the raising of the question of using human blastocysts, that is, fertilized human embryos, in stem cell research. But it's important to emphasize that stem cell therapy and research using stem cells is not at all new. It has been going on in a legitimate context and in a way that the church has never had any problems with for many years. As we'll see, one of the most commonly used forms of stem cell therapy has been for several decades the practice of bone marrow transplantation. But in order to highlight recent developments that have brought new potential for ethical use of stem cells, I would like to introduce this selection in our course by looking at an article by David Albert Jones, which recently appeared in the Catholic periodically The Tablet, and entitled The Ethical Cell Research Breakthrough. The occasion of his article was the awarding of the Nobel Prize for Medicine to Professor Shinya Yamanaka of Japan, as well as to Sir John Gurdon, for their work in biology, their work in medicine connected with stem cells, and in the case of John Gurdon, as Professor Jones notes, there was also the cloning of a frog, one of the first cloning procedures. The question he raises and appropriately answers is, what are stem cells? And the answer is that all cells, as we have seen, derive from the fertilized zygote, and the early cells of the human embryo have the capacity to develop into any kind of tissue. This is referred to as totipotency. As time goes by and the embryo develops, the cells become less capable of universal transformation and become what is called pluripotent, that is, they're capable of becoming many different kinds of tissue, and then as the embryo develops even further, most of the cells have a specific function, and when they reproduce are capable of being only what they are, that is, skin cells, nerve cells, cells of the digestive tract, and so forth. But within the human body, and within every body, there remain cells that still have the potential for becoming multiple different kinds of cells, and these are referred to as stem cells. They exist throughout the body. They are quite plentiful in the bone marrow, where they give rise not only to the red and white blood cells and the platelets, but also to other cells that are primarily involved in immunological reactions and which are usually regarded as part of the white blood cell lines, but which can also exist in the tissues. However, as Dr. Jones points out, there are also stem cells in the cornea, in human epithelial tissue, even in the central nervous system. Anywhere that the healing of tissues is going to require the capacity to create multiple different kinds of cells. The difficulty has always been that these stem cells on the surface, that is to say under the microscope, often don't look much different from other cells of the type that they differentiate into, just perhaps a bit more primitive, but they do exist. And so in some ways, any movement of one kind of tissue to another part of the body for use in healing probably involves the transfer of stem cells to that portion of the body as well. What we refer to here, however, is the specific use of stem cells for therapeutic purposes. And as we'll shortly describe in a bit more detail, the controversies over their use arise chiefly from the fact that embryonic cells, with their capacity to become any kind of tissue, have become in the minds of some researchers the gold standard according to which all other stem cells are judged, and their desire to create stem cell lines derived from embryonic sources was the source of a great deal of political controversy and financial skullduggery based on promises that were really impossible and very unreasonable. Some people may remember an election in California a number of years ago where billions of dollars were set aside for embryonic stem cell research only. That is, stem cell research that would exclusively be derived from the destruction of human embryos. Of course, the Catholic Church objected to this, and my suspicion is that the vocal objection of the Church was one of the weapons which the supporters of this legislation used in an attempt to point out how important the research was, important enough that a dangerous institution like the Catholic Church would attempt to mobilize against it. But back to Dr. Jones' article, he points out that Dr. Yamanaka in Japan discovered a technique of transforming ordinary adult cells, which were not themselves stem cells, into stem cells. That is, they were given the ability to become stem cells. Originally, this involved using a virus intermediary. Subsequently, methods have been developed of doing this without necessarily using viruses. There remain questions and uncertainties, but the point of this research is that it's possible now to create tissue, to create cells, that is, which hopefully then could become various kinds of tissue from an original donor, which would then be used in that person's own body. And this remains one of the important factors and one of the issues in embryonic stem cell research, which rendered the whole question so problematic. And I would advise you to spend a little time reading Dr. Jones' article, which I believe is a very good summary. And in the meantime, if we could drop down number two to the question of the biology of stem cells. I have pointed out in the first two paragraphs what I've already mentioned, that stem cell therapies, including bone marrow transplantation, have been going on for a very long time, but that controversy arose when the issue of using embryonic cells in order to create what were thought to be much more effective cell cultures that could become any kind of tissue were held up as the next great breakthrough in medicine. The fundamental problem with this approach is that if it were successful, and indeed one can induce embryonic cells to become various kinds of tissue, the basic problem would remain that those cells would have the genetic characteristics and all the genetic cell markers that would make them recognizable as foreign tissue if there was an attempt made to transplant them into a donor. So embryonic tissues derived from sacrificed embryos have the genetic characteristics of those embryos and are recognized as such by the immune systems of any host into which they would be transplanted. So, theoretically, anyone who received such tissues therapeutically would probably need to have some kind of immunosuppressive therapy in order to keep from rejecting that tissue. This highlights again the very great value of forms of therapy that involve taking tissue from the individual that are intended later to be put back into the individual in order to facilitate healing. But this limitation of embryonic stem cell therapy was significantly downplayed by its supporters when the height of the controversy and especially the financial implications of the question of federal aid for such research was raised rather highly. If you drop down to the first chart in the section under the biology of stem cells, I've included there a chart from an article in the New England Journal of Medicine that was published in 2003, the article entitled Adult Stem Cells for Tissue Repair, and it describes the potential clinical applications of tissue that has been derived from effectively from human bone marrow intended for tissue repair or replacement. And notice that there are a very, very large number of diseases and categories, everything from diseases of the bone, genetic diseases, to hepatitis, to myocardial infarction, that is a heart attack, to various kinds of problems with the blood vessels of the limbs, chronic limb ischemia, and so on and so forth, difficulties with the eyes, with the kidneys, neurological disorders, and even stroke. And all of these have been studied and look promising, and some of them are actually being used therapeutically. Adult stem cells have been extremely successful, and the list of effective therapies is very long indeed. Now, that white-colored chart only shows what has been done with cells derived from blood stem cells, that is, cells that are harvested from the bone marrow. In the next table, which is actually labeled Table 2, it's also from the same article, adult human stem cells and their primary direction of differentiation. This gives you some idea of the different kinds of stem cells that are in the body and what they then become. And it gives you a sense of the wide range of different kinds of stem cells that exist, many of which have only just begun to be tapped and used therapeutically. And I should mention that there's absolutely no ethical problem with the use of these kinds of tissues. Then if we drop down to the next section, the chart entitled Contrast Between Professor Yamanaka's Method, and by the way, that blue highlighted text represents a link which you can use to go to a web page that describes his method in some detail and the variations of it that have subsequently been produced. His method of inducing pluripotent stem cells, that is, taking a cell from an adult person's body, treating it, and enabling it to become a pluripotent stem cell, a cell capable of becoming many different kinds of cells, and differentiating that from what is on the lower part of that same diagram, and that is embryonic stem cell research. And you can see that in the upper part of that diagram, it shows an adult person donating skin cells, which are treated, and this is mentioning or employing the use of retroviruses, although that's not the only way to create them, and we end up with stem cells. Another method, which of course has the disadvantage not only of destroying a human being, but also resulting in stem cells that are not the same genetically as those from the donor, and therefore run the risk of being rejected by the recipient, involves taking an egg, allowing it to develop to the blastocyst stage, then destroying this embryonic human being and harvesting the cells to obtain these very pluripotent or totipotent stem cells. And the last chart in this section specifically shows taking a blastocyst, creating embryonic stem cells, which then can be used, can be enabled to differentiate into different cell types. Again, the Catholic Church specifically opposes any research that creates and then destroys, or simply creates human beings for the sake of research, and that is the objection. And as it's turned out, as I've mentioned, embryonic stem cells have not yet yielded any therapeutic research or any therapeutic practice that has been proven clinically to help anyone, whereas adult stem cells, not yet using the induced method of Professor Yamanaka, but using stem cells that are harvested in ways that we've already mentioned, these techniques and these therapies are very widely used and very extensively practiced, and successfully so. If we then drop down to number 3, it's rather simple, and this is a citation from Benedict XVI, a text that he, an oration that he delivered in 2006 during a symposium on Rome, and it demonstrates the Catholic Church's unequivocal support of somatic stem cell research, that is, stem cell research that does not create and or destroy human embryos. And as the Pope says, somatic stem cell research deserves approval and encouragement when it felicitously combines scientific knowledge, the most advanced technology in the biological fields, and ethics that postulate respect for the human being at every stage of his or her existence. So the Church supports ethically acceptable stem cell research. The prospects opened by this new chapter in research are fascinating. They give a glimpse of the possible cure of degenerative tissue diseases. And he asks, how is it possible not to feel the duty to praise all those who apply themselves to this research and all who support the organization and cover its expenses? And again, there has been a specific condemnation of embryonic stem cell research in texts that we have already studied that are also enumerated here in this section. I should add that one of the variants on the embryonic stem cell approach that has been emphasized or has been touted but has been not successful to this point is a form of cloning that would take a nucleus from the donor, from the person who is intended eventually to make use of the tissue that would be produced, and to place it into a fertilized cell, which would then be encouraged to act as a fertilized cell and produce a tissue that could become a variety of different things. This generally involves the destruction of a human fertilized cell or of a cell that's already begun to divide. Clearly, the church would regard this as highly problematic. And indeed, one of the problems that it entails is that this resultant tissue would have one of the disadvantages that we've already mentioned, and that is that the cytoplasm would not be the same as the cytoplasm of the individual who donated the cell originally. The cytoplasm contains organelles, a whole variety of small organs, one of them being the mitochondria, which has its own genetic material, and indeed there are diseases which specifically involve anti-mitochondrial antibodies. So creating a tissue that would have mitochondria from another donor would conceivably have problems as well. So the various variants on the embryological stem cell research approach have a variety of both ethical and moral problems, as well as potential therapeutic problems that are not present in the area of somatic or adult stem cell research. And what I've done finally in section 4 is to include a rather lengthy but very helpful text from Pope Benedict XVI's encyclical Caritas in Veritate, which we have not looked at previously, but which provides, again, an overarching perspective for many of the beginning of life issues that we have looked at. And what the Pope proposes in this encyclical is rather analogous to what we've already seen in John Paul II's Theology of the Body, an attempt to look at much more broadly the theological and spiritual issues, not just focusing on the question of specific condemnations, but trying to ask the question, what then should be our attitude? How can we have an approach that would enable us to engage in a proper ethical respect for the world around us and to avoid the descent into a utilitarianism that would see ourselves and each other as instruments of manipulation, whether by science or for political or social ends. And so if we could look at number 51, he says that we are invited as a contemporary society to seriously review our lifestyle and recognize the tendency that we have, which is prone to hedonism, the pursuit of pleasure, and consumerism, regardless of harmful consequences. He points out that this is destructive of the environment, and he's not only referring to the external environment of the world around us, although that is something that he is particularly concerned with, but also the broader question of the spiritual and, if you will, transcendent environment which we occupy as human beings, which have an eternal destiny. He does mention the very significant issues of desertification, decline in productivity, and he tries to link these together with a lack of respect for or veneration for the beauty of what one has in nature. He highlights in the section that I've colored in black with a white background, the church has a responsibility toward creation and must assert this responsibility in the public sphere. The criticism that Catholics should not attempt to influence others is invalid insofar as we believe that the approach that the Church recommends is one that is one of respecting the creation and a corrective against precisely the ills that have been so widespread and are becoming so prominent. And so the Pope recommends not only that we work to protect mankind from self-destruction, both physical and moral, but the need for what he calls a human ecology, correctly understood. And then he goes on to say, human ecology should be respected within society, environmental ecology also benefits. So it's more than just environmental ecology. In order to protect nature, he goes on to say, it's not enough to intervene with economic incentives. The decisive issue is the overall moral tenor of society. and then he summarizes and draws together the issues of beginning of life concerns with this sense of responsibility for the environment. If there's a lack of respect for the right to life and to a natural death, if human conception, gestation, and birth are made artificial, if human embryos are sacrificed to research, the conscience of society ends up losing the concept of human ecology, or what we might call interconnectedness and interdependence, and along with it, that of environment, environmental ecology. And there's this beautiful phrase, the book of nature is one and indivisible. It takes in not only the environment, but also life, sexuality, marriage, the family, social relations, and in a word, integral human development. So he advocates our learning to read, to appreciate, and to perceive the hand of God in what he calls the book of nature. And I should add that this is a phrase that has a very long history in Christianity, right back to patristic times, and then it was a favorite subject of meditation and reflection during the Middle Ages. The idea that within the book of nature, one sees the hand of God, one can perceive God's will and God's actions in the world around us, and so it creates a vision of a potential for science, for intervention, and for safeguarding and protecting that is in harmony with our encouragement, our command from God to be stewards of the world and of our own bodies. And then down in number 74, he particularly highlights the area of bioethics and says the very real possibility of integral human development is radically called into question. He describes it as a most delicate and critical area and goes on to say that there is effectively a false dichotomy. We are presented with a choice between two types of reason, reason open to transcendence or reason clothed within immanence. And the dichotomy is that it's the latter, reason clothed within immanence, which is thought to be the proper perspective of science. But his point is, one can have both. One can be aware of God immanent in creation and at the same time be open to transcendence. And he points out that the problem of our self-centered use of technology is irrational because it implies a rejection of meaning and value. There is no universally agreed-upon sense of meaning and value. The attempt to claim a specific set of ethics or moral values as fundamental or determinative is rejected in our society. That renders it irrational. And he concludes with the section, which is also a citation, from Dignitas Personae, entranced by an exclusive reliance on technology, reason without faith is doomed to flounder in an illusion of its own omnipotence. Faith without reason risks being cut off from everyday life. He mentions that in our culture, conscience is simply invited to take note of technological possibilities. Conscience is not encouraged to intervene or to declare one thing as forbidden or dangerous as contrasted with another. And he points out that this is particularly prominent in the areas of in vitro fertilization, embryo research, the question of manufacturing clones and hybrids. And he says all of this is being promoted in today's highly disillusioned culture. And of course, it becomes fascinating. It becomes entrancing. It carries on almost the trappings of a new form of transcendence, a new and exciting alternative to the otherwise boring and humdrum nature of life. And he also points out that this is also concomitant with a pro-euthanasia mindset that claims that a control over life under certain circumstances is appropriate when that life is no longer deemed worth living. And this is a, as he puts it, materialistic and mechanistic understanding of human life. He asks the question, how can we be surprised by the indifference shown towards situations of human degradation when such indifference extends even to our attitude towards what is and is not human? But he doesn't just reprimand, he doesn't just call into question the concerns of our societies. He does point out a new possibility if we drop down to number 77, with which the section ends. In the last paragraph, he says, We consider the spiritual dimension that must be present if real human development is to be authentic. And he says it requires new eyes and a new heart capable of rising above a materialistic vision of human events, capable of glimpsing in development the beyond that technology cannot give. We have to have our eyes opened to the true beyond for which we were created. By following this path, it's possible to pursue the integral human development that takes its direction from the driving force of charity in truth, the title of this encyclical. And so he's presented a vision of rising up above a materialistic vision, an attempt to a glimpse again the beyond for which we're destined, but which we can also see and read if we have the eyes and ears to do so in this book of creation that will enable us to live and to have an alternative to a culture that looks excitedly towards mechanistic domination and control of human reproduction as a way forward.